You're live.
Hey, everybody. You are listening live to United Public Radio Network. This is an abbreviated version of Voice of the People Radio this afternoon. We come to you live from 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Saturdays. Of course, you're hitting us past the bottom of the first hour. We've just been going through some of the craziness that happens. Occasionally that happens. So when we're up on our podcast, if you see that it's a little bit shorter than our normal broadcast, it is. It's not an error by the station. When you find us posted on SoundCloud, Podbean, or whatever, you will just know this is just a slightly shorter episode. So, you know, with that being said, you know, looking at it, we're talking, you know, and I wish sometimes when I go live into the program like this that everybody in the listening audience on United Public Radio Network had kind of a clue as to where I was going, so I don't have to feel like I'm repeating myself. But for the sake of the conversation that I was just having with Joe Montaldo back at UPRN headquarters before we bumped into the queue and live on the air, we're talking about, you know, the idea of healthcare reform, of course, you know, and just to give a bottom line number on it, if there were 300 million people in the United States and everybody was issued $200,000 to $2 million, and we went $2 million because we went high on this, folks, $2 million medical expense account, courtesy of a bond underwritten by the United States government. So we're talking about modeling something close to what happens when you are born in the Dominion of Canada. You have about $2 million of medical expense money is assigned to you under Canada's single-payer medical care system. So the idea behind this was, how much would it actually cost to, you know, to in cash to put a $2 million price tag on 300 million Americans for medical care. Now, for obvious reasons, not everybody in the United States is going to run through $2 million in medical care, okay, in their lifetime. However, you know, with our advancing age of our population in the United States and coming up on that threshold where 25% or more of Americans will be age 65 or older, which means they will have to be enrolling in the Medicare and Medicaid programs under Congress, which has been heavily at the center of this entire Senate health care bill debate. And we're really not touching too far into the topic with the Senate health care reform. But when we look at that, $2 million for every American at 300 million American citizens at the moment, you are looking at a price tag, you know, of $6 trillion. Okay, the government could underwrite this in a single annual bond issue. The American gross national product would take a hit. The American gross national product has been over $27 trillion a year for the last several years. I haven't even looked for a concrete number from the Congressional Budget Office or the Congressional Accounting Oversight Office or whatever they're wanting to call it, because even that government department underwent name changes under the Obama administration. It's kind of like playing the shell game or find the queen, you know, with the three card Monty. We had the government doing that with us for about 8 years with the American Affordable Care Act law, and find the queen, and maybe you'll get your health care bills paid for, or you could end up having to pay a $6,000 to $20,000 fine, right? So, be that as it may, $6 trillion outlay from the Congressional Budget Office would be what it would take. Now, if you graduated that in, okay, we're talking about the Senate health care bill actually taking $1 trillion out of the existing Medicaid budget, which is the big thing that everybody is harping on in the mainstream media. If you listen very carefully to what they're saying in the mainstream media and what has actually been published, the mainstream media is saying something completely different than what is actually in the Senate proposed version of the health care bill. And then due to the fact that the mainstream media is misreporting the amount and the way the sliding scale and everything works, you then have U.S. senators who are doing the backstroke or saying just flat out that they don't want to approve the Senate version of the health care reform bill because they're afraid of their constituents, the people that they represent in their state, going and doing the obvious thing, which is voting them out because they're not educating the voters in their states as to what is actually being said in the news media. They're all afraid of of opening the door. There's a fire behind the door, and you get caught in the backdraft of the fire, and the fire ends up burning you up, and you were trying to get out of the house, right? They don't want to open the door because they could feel the heat on the other side of the door, and opening the door and passing the health care reform bill as it sits in the Senate means that they're going to get flamed by their voters. They're going to be voted out, and a Democrat or another Republican is going to take their seat in Congress. In some cases, that may be what it ends up taking. But to go back to what I was saying about it, the media is saying $1 trillion is going to be taken out of Medicaid. Now, the big thing with this is $1 trillion that would be taken out of the Medicaid budget would be taken out of the Medicaid budget over 10 years. Okay? So you're talking about $100 billion in Medicaid cuts to certain programs scaled down over the course of 10 years and only in states that have previously passed the extended Medicaid funding for the American Care Act, the Obamacare Act, which was passed 8 years ago with Democrats in the House and Senate. It's not $1 trillion in one whack. It is going to be scaled down to the point that the states would have to pick up the funding. We've talked about this on Voice of the People Radio previously, by the way, but it is very important for people to understand it's not all just hinging on whether or not Senator John McCain recovers from surgery with the blood clot over his eye, or whether or not he stays in office long enough to make a vote on the health care reform bill because he's been diagnosed with a brain tumor. It really doesn't have very much to do with any of that. Okay, it all has to do with what the public's perception of the Republican support for this health care reform bill is and what the reality of it is. And, you know, when you're looking at the states having to make up the difference in the funding that they had previously been receiving in any of the states that did expand their Medicaid coverage, those states are then liable after the year 2025. So we're talking about another 8 years here. During that 8 years that the funding is being pared down, the states have to come up with a formula where they are providing some form of revenue to pick up the slack that the federal government is not paying. There is nothing that can be done with this Senate health care bill in the immediate that's going to affect who is eligible. There has been all of this screaming and hollering about the 22 million Americans who will eventually not have health care. It has been repeatedly pronounced on media outlets that 22 million people are immediately going to lose coverage and not have any medical coverage whatsoever if the Senate votes to repeal the Affordable Care Act. That is not the case. What happens is if the Affordable Care Act is repealed by the Senate, the law that was and is in place at the moment extends the Medicaid expansions and allows for the states to come in and supplement the funding, whether they're going to have to raise taxes on industry, raise taxes on the super rich for them to be able to pay more income tax. However, those states see fit to raise the money to be able to pay for those excess Medicaid coverages, which they allowed through passing the expanded Medicaid with the Affordable Care Act. Now, there are 14 states, one of which I'm broadcasting to you from in Mississippi, which did not expand the Medicaid coverage for people under the state law, and it has made it problematic for many, many people to receive any kind of insurance under the Affordable Care Act in the state of Mississippi. It has also left the state of Mississippi in a position that the state of Mississippi doesn't have to come up with supplemental funding if the senators from the state of Mississippi vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act. There is not going to be a shortfall for the state of Mississippi because the funding was never put in place to begin with 8 years ago. So 14 of the states have no real reason not to support the Republican Senate move to vote yes on the Affordable Care Act repeal. Now, not all of those 14 states that voted against expanding Medicaid necessarily have Republican senators. That's another thing. This issue went to the state legislatures, and the state legislatures decided whether or not they were going to accept expanded Medicaid funding, and they actually made floor votes on it. So if you live in a state like Ohio that voted to expand its Medicaid coverage, your state representatives are the ones responsible for that, as well as your congressional and Senate representation at the time the law was voted in. And this $1 trillion, which is going to get whacked off of the Medicaid spending budget, is actually $100 billion a year over 10 years, not all at once, not throwing people to the wolves and leaving any more people than are already ineligible for care under the Affordable Care Act. It's just that their state that they live in is going to have to come up with the difference between what they're paying now and the amount of money they are receiving from the federal government. The amount of money that they're paying out in all cases, in all states, is going to go up, according to government accounting office forecasts, simply because of the fact that we have an aging population in the United States. So the funding is going to have to come in from the states that expanded Medicaid, and the states that didn't expand Medicaid under Obamacare are not going to have to worry about the shortfall with the Medicaid expansion budget, but they're still going to have to be concerned about expanding their Medicaid budget overall because every state has this burgeoning retired elderly population over 65 that's coming up, and it's a huge age transitional threshold in the United States. In the next 20 years, the United States is pretty much population-wise going to be resembling the situation that's ongoing now in Japan, where you have a larger senior population than you have a childbearing population, generationally speaking. So they're already tackling those problems. I think we should be looking at what the Japanese are doing with their health system as well, because you don't learn anything if you don't look and see what other people are doing instead of nitpicking and pecking at what you've already got and complaining about how it doesn't work and how it needs to be thrown out and everything needs to be started over again. And everybody that's in this Republican caucus that had been voted in, especially Tea Party members, are the ones who are being looked at by their voters, because the voters are saying, hey, we voted you guys in under the presumption that you were going to get rid of Obamacare. We didn't want Obamacare. We didn't necessarily want Obama to be reelected in 2012. You guys were all elected with the premise of get rid of Obamacare, even if we can't get rid of Obama. So those are the guys who are really in danger at this point. They're the ones who are looking down the proverbial gun barrel. They're the ones that have to support the repeal of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare, because their constituents are going to come back and say, you told us you were going to get rid of Obamacare when the time came for you to vote for it on the floor of the House or the floor of the Senate. Why didn't you support the repeal bill? And there are individuals who are, you know, they're going to be taken to task by their voters, and they know that that's, you know, that's pretty much their immediate political future. But looking at it in a long term, again, it would cost the U.S. government about $6 trillion to put into place a permanently bonded single-payer healthcare system with $2 million available immediately for every man, woman, and child in the United States based on accurate population number of 300 million, which means that, you know, to be honest, you won't have a total assessment of the real population in the United States until there's another census. Well, the census only happens every 10 years. So the Congressional Budget Office would have to look at it. There's going to have to be some play with it one way or the other, either way you go, even with an Affordable Care Act repeal, because you don't know what your real population is until you get the people out there on the ground knocking on the doors, and then you get the really important thing, which is not to have people lying to the census takers about how many people live in the house, so that the government can accurately and adequately fund something like a single health care system. Because if you have census takers who are going around in the year 2020 and you still have people in the United States who are here illegally worrying about being deported in the year 2020, you are going to have the most underreported amount of illegal aliens in the United States' history, which is what it's looking like now. I don't know that the Trump administration is actively pursuing an immigration and naturalization reform of any kind that's going to change that situation. Until they change that situation, they can't forecast that you're going to get an accurate number, because the person that's living in the place, whether they're renting it, leasing it, they own it, okay, whether they have 15 people living in the home and only 4 people are being reported to the census in 2020, is going to be entirely up to the Trump administration and the tack that they take with the immigration problem. And the biggest problem with the immigration problem at this point is that you have anywhere between 11 and 17 plus million people living in the United States who are working minimum wage jobs under fictitious Social Security numbers, or Social Security numbers of dead people, or Social Security numbers that belong to somebody else that lives in another state. And the United States, on the ground level, is not accurately collecting local, state, and federal taxes for any of these people. And there are people who are out of the job market at this moment in 2017 who otherwise could be employed. But somebody who is an illegal is taking that job because they're willing to do it under false documentation, or they're willing to do it under less pay, or the employer is not cooperative completely with the E-Verify system that's been in place from the federal government in order to validate your workers. The Trump administration, excuse me, but the Trump administration, in my opinion, should really be looking at that as the beginning of the solution to the medical problem, because you have crazy situations. You have things like the news that you don't want to hear. You have an illegal Mexican mother living in a suburb of Atlanta, Georgia, who goes on vacation with her family one weekend, and they go to the Atlantic seashore and they go to a town and they rent a cabin, and she begins to have a mental breakdown of some kind, and allegedly, at this point, we have to say allegedly here on Voice of the People Radio, because we don't want to get United Public Radio Network, its ownership, or anybody in any kind of trouble, so we have to also give a disclaimer. Just like they use that allegedly in the news reports, allegedly stabbed all of the children but one and the husband to death in the home. And one daughter underage, who was reportedly around 9 years of age, gave testimony to the police in a deposition. However, you depose a 9-year-old child in a case like this. We're not going to get into all that, but the 9-year-old was able to give the police enough information to say that in the news headlines that her mother begged her forgiveness before cutting her. Okay, and we're not even you're going to get into further details with that, but the woman was advised to have a public attorney appointed for her after she told the judge in her arraignment hearing that she didn't want or didn't need to be represented by an attorney. One was appointed to her by the judge sitting on the bench in the hearing. And then the public attorney, according to news reports, declined to have a psychological evaluation done on this mother. But getting back to the reason why this particular case being brought up by your host here on Voice of the People Radio is that the mother was an illegal Mexican migrant worker who then, I don't know the legal status of her now deceased husband, but she had four or five children, now decedents, victims in this case where she allegedly stabbed them all to death and failed to stab the last child that gave the evidence to the police. But here's the crux of the matter. This is not the only Mexican mother with multiple children, you know, living out in suburban America at this point where the house, you know, not just the housing situation, but the health and human services department in the county actually has a historical record of this mother being brought in with a case manager with reported issues in the home involving the children, because the children are U.S. citizens. And that's issue number two with tackling the Immigration and Naturalization Service issues with the Trump administration. Before you even get into the whys and wherefores and all the dotted I's and crossed T's of a medical reform act, is how do you accurately count when you have a household and you have four or five children, you have two parents who may or may not be illegal, but the parents are the parents of the children, regardless of whether or not their status is legal or illegal. The children are granted U.S. citizenship status as soon as they're born in the United States. Whether the mother is having the children at a hospital, which means that the hospital ends up having to pay for it because they're an illegal migrant worker, and they go to the emergency room, they're having a baby, and the hospital is required by law to not turn away anybody that's having a child. Okay, so regardless of her legal status in the United States, they cannot tell her no when she goes to give birth at given hospital X in the United States. Under the existing laws, the child is born in the United States. The child is a U.S. citizen, regardless of the mother's citizenship status. And so the child then becomes an anchor baby. And I know, yes, there are a lot of people listening to the show who probably would be offended by the term anchor baby, but they can go ahead, they could be offended, because when you're offended, what happens to you? Nothing. But using that term as something that a lot of people would understand, Once the first child is born, it is then just a matter, usually, of course, that the family then proceeds to have two, three, four more children, such as the case with this example, with this woman who allegedly murdered her entire family and is now in custody of the authorities, okay? So you have this family, and where is the revenue coming from the parent side? If they're illegal, they're not legally paying into the tax-based system, but their children are using the public school system, the children are using the hospital system, the children are assigned caseworkers from the Department of Health and Human Services in whatever county and whatever state that they live in. So the children are an expense which is being borne by the rest of the taxpayers in the country. The rest of the taxpayers are not getting any relief from this tax burden because it is unfairly distributed towards them, while there is no penalty against the mother who's in the country illegally having children up to the age range of, I think, 10, 11, 12 years old. So this is, you know, it's not a new problem. This is a problem that was known about back when President Bush was going to sit down with Vicente Fox, president of Mexico, September of 2001. And go over details of an arrangement between simply between the United States and Mexico, not Mexico and Costa Rica and Nicaragua, Honduras, all the rest of the Central and South American countries, just the U.S. and Mexico, to try to hash out the migrant worker issue. And, of course, September 11th happened. That issue got put on the back burner by the U.S. government. It has never been brought back forward, and I personally would petition the White House and President Trump to go ahead and bring it back forward, get something done about it. If the White House has to end up going into federal court to be able to suspend the ability for foreign nationals to have children born on U.S. soil and then have automatic citizenship granted for those children, there are legal precedents for it. It was done at the beginning of the 20th century. There was also an immigration prohibition put in place at the beginning of the 20th century to prevent mass-scale migration out of China to the United States after so many Chinese workers were publicly known to have worked on the western end of the Great Transcontinental Railroad projects where Chinese were excuse me, almost used exclusively like slave labor by the railroad companies because there wasn't any federal regulation at the time. And they were paid next to dirt wages. They weren't considered the U.S. citizenships, and they could petition the state for U.S. citizenship once the railroad brought the population of the state up to the level that the state could petition the federal government or the territory could petition the federal government to then become a state, then those Chinese nationals who had been living in that territory that could prove that they had residence beyond X number of years, whatever the residential requirement and so forth was, they could then be granted citizenship status in those states, even when they were still not allowed under the territorial laws to be property owners. That's another social issue entirely, but it's been done. And we have historical precedent in the history of the United States of not only the president but the federal government going in and saying enough was enough. They didn't want large-scale immigration from other countries. And it's been done on the other side to limit Eastern European immigration after the fact. Once everything was done to stop a mass Asian migration to the west of the United States, there was also immigration restrictions put in place in the United States to keep half of the population from countries in Eastern Europe from coming to the United States. They were just flatly prohibited from entering the country. And meanwhile, people in Western European countries, such as Italy, were allowed to immigrate to the United States, and that was seen as a great injustice done to those people by the people in their countries who were seeking to immigrate to the United States, possibly, you know, to not only have a better life, but be able to send for their relatives to come to the United States. They were just simply shut out. You know, in those good old days, it was easier for the legislation to come down the pike that just slammed the door in everybody's face. And until you can get an accurate count on how many people are actually living in the United States, which means removing the fear of mass deportations to get an accurate count of who is actually living here. You know, you shouldn't have to do a census by going through the public school system and counting the number of kids and counting what the parents put on the children's information when they register them for school. And they're asked for that important information, which declares whether or not the child is Caucasian, African American, Hispanic, or other national origin, or American Indian, Alaskan Native, etc. That all important information is being used by your county and state governments to be able to try to tabulate how many people are declaring the fact that they are of Hispanic or Latino origin, but aren't necessarily in the country illegally. And I'm just saying that it's about time that as a country we stop playing the three-card Monty game and shuffling it around so that when the parents take the children in to try to apply for anything from supplemental nutritional SNAP, food stamp benefit program, which, you know, which is another thing, or the aid for dependent children, where there is an adult who is working to support the household, and the household is eligible for certain amounts of funding up to 2 years out of 5 years, etc. That the parents are legally in the country, because the issue is not being looked at as whether or not the parents have legal immigration status. The counties and the agencies are looking at the children's citizenship status, because the children are dependent on the adults, regardless of the adults' legal status. And so that's how the funding is being distributed. And the states really should be after the Trump administration to do this. And they should be after their representatives in Congress and their senators to push for this, because the states are the ones who are ultimately going to be the first ones in line to be collecting the additional legal tax revenue that's entitled to the states and the municipalities who are spending all of this money for healthcare, emergency services, and schools, where the children are U.S. citizens and the parents are not. And the parents are not being afforded any out, you know, or we can look at it and say an in to the system, because the parents are afraid of being deported, because everybody thought when Donald Trump took the oath as the 45th president of the United States that the first thing that was going to happen was ICE buses were going to be showing up in the neighborhoods where there were high numbers of Latin American or, you know, Hispanic or other national origin families living in communities, underreported or not. And so we saw during the first 6 months of the Trump administration a natural decline in the number of reported crime incidents in neighborhoods which were primarily Latino. And it wasn't because the amount of crime in the Latino neighborhoods was actually decreasing. It was the fact that the crimes were going unreported to the authorities, because the victims of the crimes were afraid that the moneymaker in the household, or the one that had the job, was going to end up being deported from the United States and leaving the rest of the family separated in cases where the children would be separated from one or both of the parents. They would then have their children subject to the foster care system of those states in particular. You know, so we could take a look at that and say, well, why is that such a big deal? Well, beyond the fact that the parents don't want to be separated from their children, you then look at this, the largest state with the, and we're just going on prima facie or face of things, the primary visual evidence, the things that you can see up front with this, because it's a multi-layered problem, the onion goes all the way to the core. And when you look at, say, why don't we want to separate the children who are citizens of the United States from the parents who are not citizens, what kind of foster care system are you then putting those children into? Now, let's look at it. The two largest states in the United States with the illegal immigration problem, and it's because of border locations. And as my wife would like to say, the most patrolled border locations where all the good stuff is. Texas and California, because that's where people are going to want to go, because that's where the good stuff is. They're not really going out there and saying, I have to drag 5 gallons of water through the back areas of the open Arizona border because I could get bit by a snake, I could bit by a scorpion, I could die of heat exhaustion. No, no, no. They're going to where the good stuff is, and then they're trying to sneak in when nobody's looking or when somebody's willing to turn a blind eye. So where are these two states, California and Texas? When you go to separate the children from the parents in these cases, if the parent is not a criminal and is thinking that they're going to be deported, in a hypothetical situation where the children are separated from the parents and they're put into foster care, the two worst states in the United States of America for foster care or for state-sponsored child welfare or child protective services, which is a misnomer. Child protective services in the state of Texas. One of the worst in the country. Children in the Texas Child Protective Services program disappear into human sex trafficking on a daily basis. The Department of Child Protective Services in the state of Texas, according to the administrator of the Child Protective Services Agency in the state of Texas, to testimony given to the Republican-led state Senate in the state of Texas, is underfunded by over $1 billion a year and unable to cope with the situation where the children in the child protective system, the foster children, are running away, and within 24 to 48 hours, if they are not found by the police, who don't have the money to pay for finding them, they are then in the clutches of pimps. They are becoming prostitutes at the hands of these adults who are more than willing to freely traffic in these children and destroy their lives and introduce them to drug abuse and get them hooked on drugs so that they continue being child prostitutes because they are running away from a child protective services system in a state like Texas, in a state like California, that's broken, that's underfunded, and then being told quite frankly and front-facedly by the Republican-led state administration, who says, no, we're not going to fund you. You're not showing enough results, because if you were showing results, we wouldn't have the problem of these children being human trafficked. And that's only because these legislators are not having their personal lives disrupted by having their children taken into the foster care system. They're not exposed to it. It's just a bottom line number on a spreadsheet somebody brings in as a department head, and they say, nah, we're not funding you. You're not getting the $1 billion that you need. So let the system continue doing what it's doing. Let the foster children get turned into drug addicts, get turned into child prostitutes until they're old enough to go to jail. And then they're in the correction system. And like I said, folks, the onion has many layers here. So then finally, when the child prostitute, who may or may not have a lifelong disability due to medical disorder, due to sexually transmitted disease, which then puts them in another category of society altogether, is exposed to the prison system. And whether they're under the age of 18 or not, they are exposed to the prison system. Think, for example, in the state of Texas, they're now remanded over to the custody of the state until they can go through some form of re-educational process and rehabilitation, which, of course, the administrator of the Child Protective Services Agency has already said is inadequate. The Corrections Department of the state of Texas says, we're done with you. We're going to remand you back to the Child Protective Services Agency for the state, and then the kids are put back into the foster care system until they're 18 years of age. And all of this has to do with somebody saying, we don't have enough money. We're not getting good enough results. We're not going to fund it. And it starts with breaking the families up, or the situation already being bad enough at home because parents are afraid of being reported. They have a really not the best of worlds to grow up in, but they're the anchor babies here, folks. And the parents are going to keep their jobs. Whether or not the problem is resolved through the Child Protective Services, whether or not the state administration ever gets funded, the problem goes back through all the way back to the top layer of the onion, where it's the parents aren't reported by county agencies when they're going in and they're asking for financial assistance, when they're getting the kids registered under the Food Supplemental Nutritional SNAP food stamp program, when they're using the children as dependents to qualify for state-paid public housing, all of that at the top layer of the onion comes down to whether or not the county agency is going to, under a form of state law, take the moral stance that the parents of these dependent children should be reported to the Immigration and Naturalization Service. And they're not. And so the problem continues because there's no worker registration program. There is no national amnesty being discussed where these families won't be broken up. And it bleeds into the healthcare system because the children are being taken to local clinics that are being run by nonprofit agencies. They're being run by counties. They're being run near you, whether you want to accept it or not. There has got to be a sliding scale healthcare facility in just about every county in America that has a population base to substantiate the existence of a sliding scale, low-cost medical facility. Those low-cost medical facilities, or family healthcare centers, as they're commonly called, are predominantly reliant on the Medicaid system for their funding. And that's where the people in Congress are looking at it and saying, these are a lot of cases. These are rural family healthcare facilities. They're heavily reliant on Medicaid. You're going to cut $1 trillion off from Medicaid. Well, where is that going to come from? Of course, it's always going to come from the bottom, right? Everything that gets cut is always going to be cut from the bottom when they talk about the budget cuts. That's been the assumption forever. Forever in the United States. It's been the assumption that the first place it gets cut is at the bottom. And then the amount that's being paid into by the super rich 1% or the super rich 12% or whatever you want to call it is always going to be cut at the top. Because since you're not paying it out at the bottom for the super poor people or the indigent, then you can afford to relieve the burden that's being placed on that 1 to 12 to 15, whatever percent that's up there at the top. Because why should they have to be paying for that? You know, when they could go out and buy a new car with the money that they're going to save on not having to pay the state to pay for the Medicaid, to pay for the low income or the low indigent people who are using the family health care centers. So they do, you know, they deserve a break. And that's where the entire system is kind of twisted around itself, because you have a system that is being run by career politicians. It's not being run by the people that were in something like the Tea Party movement of 8 to 10 years ago. And the sad thing is that the people in the Tea Party movement in the United States from 8 to 10 years ago are now more concerned with being career politicians and being reelected and keeping that position in the House of Representatives, or in some cases, the United States Senate, when they originally promised that, hey, we don't like any of this stuff, and you vote for me, and I'm going to vote for it, I'm going to repeal it, I'm going to get rid of it. And now it's, well, we haven't been able to get rid of it yet, but vote me back in. And the next time I'm in there, we're going to vote for the repeal, and we're going to get rid of it, and we're going to do it the right way. But we're not going to really solve the whole problem, which is why John Q. Public can't go find a job, because it's being taken by somebody who's not being reported to the Immigration and Naturalization Service, because their employer opts to accept their documentation, which may be fraudulent, not go through the right system, the E-Verify, and gives them a job where they're working at the federal minimum wage or slightly under. And it happens. It's there. It exists. These people going into these offices and reporting this information to the caseworkers, the social workers, the people that go to say they care about people, and they have a degree, and they're working for the local county agency, and they go in and they say, I'm working. Well, are you making, you know, what are you making? Are you making minimum wage? I'm not making minimum wage. Well, you have four kids. Why? Yeah, I have four kids. My kids are all legal. And they're not obligated to report to the state that the parents are undocumented migrant workers, that they may have moved into the state from Nebraska over the last 6 months because it got cold there. And so they're migrant workers. They went from working and doing farm work that nobody wanted to do, according to President Bush. If you remember his famous remarks about people that came into the United States that were willing to go work on fruit farms and pick strawberries, because those were jobs that other Americans didn't want to do. You know, how many people are out in California right now that would probably take a job working and picking strawberries or other fruit if it was a livable wage, if it could cover their health care expenses. That's what those people were worried about. That's what those people were concerned with when they went and they voted in the Congress that they've got now. But they still have to work within a local and a state legislature that's looking at the problem and looking at the top layer of the onion, and they're saying, if I peel the top layer off of this onion, it's sure going to make tears come to my eyes. I don't want to do that. You know, so everybody wants to overlook the parents that have the kids that are in the system. Nobody wants to be responsible and say, let's start by naturalizing these people who are in the United States legally so they can start contributing to the tax base. And those who are not in any kind of naturalization program, that are not listed under any guest worker program, that do not have a green card, that do not have a visa, any children that are born in the United States, to those people who, for whatever reason, make the choice not to go and have themselves listed under a program like that, would then forego the right for their children to have U.S. citizenship. And that ends the anchor baby problem. That stops the issue cold. You no longer have people sneaking into the United States up in Vancouver, Washington, who are living in Canada, possibly illegally there as well, simply to be able to have their child and have their child's birth registered in the state of Washington so that when their child becomes an adult, their child then has the option of coming from Canada across the border back into the United States and as an adult raising a family with citizenship status in the United States. We're seeing it all the time. It is happening on the borders in Texas. You are seeing people coming to Mexico on travel permits visas and having children in Mexican-Texas border towns at midwifery houses who have been set up specifically for the benefit of these foreign nationals to have a child born in the United States with U.S. citizenship. We've talked about it before. We've cited articles where the interviews were given and the answers given to the interviewer by the Chinese mother of the baby were that their child would be able to come back to the United States in 21 years as an adult with full legal citizenship status because the state of their birth would be Texas. The state of their birth would be California. The state of their birth would be Arizona or New Mexico or Washington, in some cases Oregon, California, on the West Coast. And there's not anything being done about it on a national level. Thousands of citizens for the future of America who will grow up in foreign countries. They will grow up in Central American countries, possibly as a citizen of Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Honduras, Mexico, Belize, Panama. They will be coming back to the United States as an adult, and when they are asked to present their birth certificate, they will have a birth certificate that says that their nation of birth is the United States, and that they have a citizenship with whichever country they are coming back to the United States from. Even Chinese folks. And this is nothing against the people in China. Not at all. Just people who have enough money to be able to bring themselves to the United States to go to one of these birthing homes and then have their child here because they know the law says their child will be a U.S. citizen. Now, a percentage of these people go back to wherever, you know, they'll go back to Cambodia, they go back to Laos, they go back to Indonesia because they have the wherewithal to do so. If they didn't have the wherewithal to do so, of course, they wouldn't be at a Texas border town at a place which promotes natural or, you know, medicated childbirth, but strictly for the purpose of providing that child with a birth certificate that says they were born as a U.S. citizen, giving them the right as a U.S. citizen to come live in the United States, to be able to file things like forms 1030, 1050 with the United States Immigration and Naturalization Service, to bring their brothers and sisters or their parents who were not born in the United States in with them to increase the quality of their own life. And you can look for these things. They're on the internet. The documents from the government are readily available. You can petition the federal government as a citizen for a relative to receive temporary visa status to come to the United States. Now, what happens when the visas expire? Well, we've been looking at the guest worker visa program as well. And Congress in the past week expanded the S2 visa program for specialty workers in certain fields by at least 15,000 people for the 2018 year, because there is a shortfall for expertise and those workers are needed. They're not being provided by the American job market. Well, are you really surprised that the American educational system, the American job market, is unable to produce people that have comparable educations and skill sets to those in foreign countries when we are allowing the system to be fundamentally broken at a level like the citizenship and the tax rate? And it's nothing against the children of these illegal aliens. It's nothing to put blame on them, because they're innocent. The children are truly innocent in this case. But using the innocence of the children to lend a blind eye to the direction in which the country is going fundamentally on a state and local level when it comes to counting. I mean, literally, basically counting. How many are there? You know, when we ask our children, would you ask your child who's in kindergarten or first and second grade, when you're trying to show them that there are 12 eggs in a dozen, and you take out the egg carton in the kitchen and you point at the egg carton and you ask the child to count and let you know how many eggs are in the carton? Well, wouldn't it be unfair to hold your hand over one section of the egg carton so that the child counts, but the child only counts the first 8 eggs in the dozen? And the child says, I see 8 eggs in the dozen. Well, that's a true statement from the point of view of the child. From the point of view of the child, I see 8 eggs is a statement, is true. The fact that you are holding your hand over a third or the other 4 eggs in the dozen doesn't enter into the logic that the child is using, because the child is being forthright and honest in answering the question that was put to them to the best of their ability, because you're holding your hand over those other 4 eggs and not letting the child see it. Now, on a local and state and federal level, we are holding our hands over the other third of the dozen and not showing people this is exactly how many eggs are in this carton. And the carton is America. The carton isn't the illegal alien carton of eggs. The carton is the entirety of the United States of America. Okay? Just so we can get that out of the way. The carton's the whole thing. And let's hold our hand over part of it and let's say, oh, there's actually, we're only going to say that there's 8 people here and not 12. That's the fundamental problem with it. That it needs to be counted correctly in the year 2020, under the census, so that the federal government knows how many people are in the United States. In order to do that, the people have to be willing, when the census takers come to their door, not to be having Aunt Maria open the door and tell the census worker that there are 6 people living in the household when there's actually 12. That there is one family living there that has a husband, a wife, and 4 children, when there's actually 2, 3, in some cases 4 generations of the same family, or 2 or 3 families entirely living in housing conditions which are inadequate, which otherwise could be improved, they could be funded, But it's seen as just enough that the Section 8 is adequate for that, that the second half of the family that's not living in the home under the eyes of the Health and Human Services Department is there, isn't counted if those people are afraid that they're going to be removed from the country. It's just that simple. If there is a national registration for workers and a national amnesty program where people, regardless of whether or not they're from Russia, they're from Mexico, you know, they're from South Africa, they're from all over. This is not a U.S. versus Mexico problem, even though a large majority of it could have been solved by President Vicente Fox and President Bush back in 2001. But people see it as a Mexico versus America problem. People saw it during the election with President Donald Trump saying, build that wall across the border with Mexico, because that's how people perceive the problem. Did they really look at the porousness of the border with Canada? No, they didn't. They didn't see the people coming across the border from Canada as a problem. There are border issues. There are issues with the live births in the United States coming from foreign nationals who are coming over the northern borders, and it is all the way across. I mean, it's a very, very hard thing to think about, and people would say, oh, there's absolutely nobody being born to nationals in the state of Montana or the state of Wyoming. Why? Why would you say that when you know that the state's there? The border's there. It's just a longer car ride. It's just more gas. It's just a smaller town. And no hospital that receives funding that doesn't want to be prosecuted and sued out of existence in the United States is going to turn away a woman who is in labor. Fact. Go to any hospital in the United States, you go into the emergency room, and you have the signs which, and I can paraphrase here a little bit, this is, the hospital is not going to turn you away because you are in need of medical attention or you are in labor. Period. You may not be able to afford it. The hospital is still not going to turn you away. Period. The hospital may try to chase you down if you're a U.S. citizen, if you're a resident in the state where you're seeking the emergency medical care. They may hound you for the rest of your life over several hundred thousand dollars worth of hospital bills, which you may not be able to pay. But if you are a migrant worker, if you are not a U.S. citizen, and you haven't come into the United States from a country in West Africa within the last 21 days, they're not going to be looking for you in the following weeks and months. Nobody is going to devote resources to finding the guy that's not the U.S. citizen that was treated at the emergency room. They're just going to go ahead and they're going to say, well, this next guy coming in, he needs a tongue depressor used. Give him a general examination. We're going to charge $800 for that tongue depressor. Seriously? $800 for an aspirin. $800 for a Tylenol. Excuse me, folks. $10,000 a day for a hospital bed after emergency treatment for a condition. And we're being honest. I'm not going to quote sources. I'm not going to use my own experiences with the medical establishment on that and just label it and slap it back on myself either. But it's true. And that's why our healthcare costs so much. You know, $800 for a single Tylenol tablet to be administered by a nurse in a little throwaway paper cup wearing a rubber glove, given to somebody because they're in pain at the emergency room because, you know, who knows what happened. They could have tripped and fallen on the sidewalk. You know, they could have had something dropped on them while they were working. There are millions of reasons for people to go to emergency rooms in hospitals across America every day. But the underlining and fundamental why that those visits are taking place for a substantial number of the patients is because of either lack of medical insurance or the fact that they are the children of or the parents of U.S. citizen children who are in the country without citizenship, so they can't buy into the medical insurance, whether it's available under the Affordable Care Act or not. There's no illegal alien provision in the American Care Act for people that's in the country illegally working a substandard pay job to buy medical insurance. They're just the uninsured, which caused the cost of the health care to increase for those people who are paying into the Affordable Care Act or that are paying into other private insurance, so that when they do go have to go to the emergency room, they're involved in a car accident, they have car insurance. That's not the issue. All of that stuff's taken care of. When the ambulance arrives and they receive medical attention and they're not pronounced dead on the scene of the accident, they're carried to the closest hospital to receive emergency medical treatment. And the cost of that medical treatment from a car accident, which they may or may not be responsible for, is immediately impacted by the number of people who are walking the streets of the country who are not legally recognized to be here. They are not legally recognized as citizens. They do not have an entrance visa. They do not have a student visa. They do not have a visitor visa. They do not have any kind of professional visa. They are just on the streets of America, all over, in every state, in every major city, and they're all hiding from the immigration and customs and enforcement because Donald Trump was elected president. And they are not reporting the crimes in their communities because Donald Trump was elected president. They are afraid that they're going to be deported out of America and that the great life that they've been able to provide their children and themselves, and let's not overlook that. It's not all about, I'm providing a great life for my children in this country. That's why you're here illegally? No, the reason that they're here illegally is simply because the federal government and the state governments have not recognized the problem and put forward a solution. You also have the other side of this, where you have the city governments who look at it and they know they have an illegal immigration problem. They know that they have children who are citizens but are parented by those who are illegal. So they decided to pass local zoning laws, to pass local ordinances, to pass city laws that say we are not going to ask the parents of the children when they are being registered for school in the city school district, whether or not the parents of this child are U.S. citizens or have legal status to be in the country under the green card or any other program. We're just not going to do it. And kids all get registered for school. The city school district qualifies for state funding. They qualify for federal funding under the Education Department. The kids are enrolled in the school. The taxpayers are paying for the school lunch program. And yet the parents are out and they're working substandard jobs. They're not receiving any form of protection. They're not receiving Medicaid. They're not receiving Medicare. They're not receiving the benefit of a comfortable retirement age of 68 to 72 years of age, where the United States government guarantees that they will have some kind of pension outside of working for substandard pay. You know that the people who are employing these illegal immigrants are not paying into, there's no Fidelity 401k for your unnaturalized illegal immigrant worker. Doesn't exist. Okay, and people at Fidelity, please don't sue me. You just happen to be the most popular and well-known 401k provider for a retirement fund in the United States. And again, please also don't sue United Public Radio Network over that. Thanks. Appreciate it. We've got it maybe as a free plug, but there's no 401k for unnaturalized workers, you know. There's no state workers' compensation for illegal workers. If a guy falls off a scaffold working on the outside of the building and he didn't happen to pass the E-Verify, what's the employer going to do? You know, usually the employer's going to say, hey, take him to urgent care. Don't report it to the State Workers' Compensation Bureau because he's not supposed to be here working. And what are the other employees going to do? The other employees are going to do what the boss said because they don't want to lose their job. They take the guy down. He gets substandard care at an urgent care facility, or they're smart enough, they take him to the emergency room, and then they don't claim to know exactly what happened. They might even go to the point of saying, we found him. He might end up telling the emergency room doctor it was a work-related accident, but then there's no investigation. And it's happening all the time. Simply because people that we are electing to our state legislatures and to our Congress and to our Senate are overlooking the top layer of the onion, which creates the problem with the Affordable Care Act, which is why it needs to be repealed and replaced. Because there's no fundamental registration without deportation for these people. Not to turn it into any kind of a political statement. It's not. I am not making it a one side of the fence or the other issue here on Voice of the People Radio. For me, it's just a role of substantiated facts repeated to you in the form of some kind of sadistic monologue, which you happen to listen to. Hopefully it's not the least interesting program on the radio for you to be listening to right now as well. And I'm not going to be apologetic about it because I believe that the people who are in charge of this system, they know better. They know that these people need medical care. And what they're getting at the emergency room is just the same as we're going to really touch on something here. What they're getting on the medical end of things is the same thing that Joe White guy is getting. Atypical, supposedly, white angle Protestant, whatever, you know, labeling. And they're getting the same level of care as if he was working at Taco Bell and had no motivation in life and had no medical insurance program and was paying, the little that he could into the Obamacare. They're going to get the same level of treatment at the emergency room. So what's the problem? And that's just a way of passing off the responsibility, you know, because there are people of all races in America who live below the poverty line. You know, but that's all we've heard about for the last 3 or 4 years now has been, this group, white privilege. This is a guy that's working for a minimum wage or less, working for a company that owns Taco Bells across the country. They would sit there and they would tell you, do you feel like received any benefit in your life from white privilege? They're going to laugh. You know, they're really, I mean, that's logically the only response that they can give you, unless they have some form of mental illness that hasn't been diagnosed. They're going to laugh because it's a ridiculous question to put to somebody, because if there really was such a thing, you know, as a race-based privilege, there wouldn't be anybody of a particular race that's supposedly been granted all of this privilege working for anything remotely resembling what you could call the bottom of the barrel economically. But you have a social order that's in play. You have a social status directive that's been put in play by a generation of people who, whether or not they want to own the responsibility for it in the United States of America, have said that we can deal with having subsequent generations of our children and our grandchildren sold into austerity just as if they were citizens in the nation of Greece who had to go and economically sign on to an austerity program to keep the economy of the nation afloat, except we as Americans are going to turn a blind eye to using that word like austerity, and we are just going to call it a low entry job. And so a whole generation of kids is being raised and living in their parents' basements. there's a whole generation of kids who are one birth group removed from the next, who are more conservative than the millennials that come after them. And to what end? To what benefit? Are they going to be supporting a political system which doesn't end up solving the problem for them? Are they going to end up being the next generation of frustrated voters because after 16 years, 8 years of an Obama administration, and then 8 years of a Trump administration going into 2024, where there's no solution to the problem, where you still have people who are unable to register as worker aliens in the United States, who are still having children, who are citizens of the United States, but the parents are illegal, who are still using the American emergency rooms and hospital system as a substitute for an actual single-payer medical healthcare system, or is the United States capable of confronting the problem and looking at it and saying, you know, 18 to 23 million people could potentially produce in a $27 trillion a year economy, could potentially produce eventually an offset to the $6 trillion it would cost for a single payer healthcare system, where if their children's rights were not taken away by the same federal government that's granting them by just having an open law that says any child born in the United States of America is a U.S. citizen automatically, even if they are born in a hospital on a U.S. military base, on a, you know, at a NATO base, in a country where the children would never even have the potential for having their parents travel to the United States because it's not a bordering country. It's not Mexico. It's not Canada. It's Uzbekistan. People are having children on military bases at the hospital because their children have the rights and privileges of a U.S. citizen. They may not be able to leave Uzbekistan for the next 20 years, but they will have the same rights as your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren, and they'll be exercising those rights as soon as they reach 21 years of age or whatever the age of legal majority is in their country to be able to afford to travel to the United States. And if there's a way for the corrupted powers that be in nations such as Uzbekistan to figure out a way to financially gain from sponsoring a person who has U.S. citizenship and sends them to the United States and puts them in a situation where they're working at a minimum wage job, because America still has that same social outlook. America still has that minimum job entry level qualification so that we can have people in the generation of Hillary Clinton grabbing for power, hoping to become the next president of the United States, staying on past the mandatory retirement ages at their companies because they don't want to give the country's next generation a chance because they want to hold on to it as long as they can to try to force a political agenda on the American people, whether they want it or not, and then fail to gain office and blame everyone else but themselves and say, it's my own fault that I failed to become the president and then continue this policy. It has been a well thought out, well entrenched, 30 plus year process for generations of American kids to have been brought up by parents who are not citizens of the United States, because the fear of losing the parent or of losing the moneymaker in the household and the fear of the beyond abject poverty that the family already lives in, the fear of total dependence and total destitution and reliance on the kindness of strangers and on county agencies has been turned into a benefit system. Instead of saying, what am I going to do because I am destitute, it has been changed into, what am I going to be able to get for nothing by getting into the United States and not getting caught? by having a child in the United States that allows me to say, I need to be able to support and feed my child. Therefore, I can stay in the country, even though under other circumstances, I would be on a bus. I would be sent back. But I have a child that's a U.S. citizen, so I have the privilege of raising that child because the United States government doesn't see fit to say that I don't have the right to raise the child in the United States because I'm not an American citizen. But since the child's an American citizen, the child has the right to have the parent raising the child, even if it's at the expense of the state, who is not sanctioning my right as a parent to be here legally in any way, shape, or form. And that, my friends, I think is the real problem with the healthcare system. Not the $6 trillion it would take to establish a medical spending account. Not a medical savings account, but a medical spending account for every one of the 300 million American people. Not the way that the insurance companies would then have to fight tooth and nail to be able to get you to choose them as a provider for your overpriced health insurance. Not the way the federal government would step in and deregulate the insurance agencies so that my living as a citizen in the northeastern state of Maine, all the way up at the end of the map by Canada, would be able to buy the same insurance coverage that would be afforded to a parent that's living in an underpopulated state like Wyoming, because I can, because the federal government deregulated the insurance, made it more affordable for me. Underlying causes. When we look at these underlying causes, and we have to do that sometimes, we have to take the hard look at the situation and say, what is really causing the problem? It's not losing $100 billion in care to people who are collecting benefits rightfully under the Medicaid system. It's not the $1 trillion those people would lose. The reality of it is it's the $6 trillion that the federal government should be spending. And that's not over the course of 10 years. That would just be one time. It would be like your state issuing a bond for you to be able to have certain types of bond ratings, buildings, construction work done in your cities. The states have to issue bonds. And the people go out and they say, the state has a AAA gold bond rating. And we want to go and we want to put this high-rise tower in the middle of downtown because it's going to increase the amount of office space. It's going to bring worldwide web technical workers and wizardry in. It's going to generate all kinds of money because everybody is going to want in on this. And they issue bonds for it. Government could do the same thing for a single-payer healthcare system. Because who would be buying the bonds? The American people buying the bonds? Well, think of it this way, folks. The insurance industry, the healthcare providers would have to be the ones buying the bonds. They would have to buy the bonds to support their own activities, to support the existence of their hospital facilities, to support the pricing that they're going to put out for their medical care, and you could make it mandatory so that not just the American taxpayer would be footing the bill for a single-payer healthcare system. Because then you wouldn't have to worry about whether or not the rural emergency or family health care centers are being put out of business or reliant on donations from nations like Qatar who come in and say, I don't want to have to, you know, do this. I want to look good. I'm going to donate money. I'm going to pay for a family health care clinic in Mississippi. Boom. Funding. Healthcare facility in southern Mississippi on the coast puts up signs in their building saying that this facility was generously donated by the royal family of the nation of Qatar. Thank you very much. Your healthcare is being subsidized by acting foreign agents, by heads of state of foreign countries for whatever benefit they can derive from being able to give the money to the small business that opens up its doors and says it's a healthcare provider for the poor and indigent. It's a charity service. The American taxpayer doesn't have to foot the bill for the $6 trillion. The American healthcare and health insurance industry certainly could pay it. Certainly over the course of another 10 years. Because look at the bottom line. And we'll come back to this with Voice of the People Radio. And we will go into this again. And we will explain how much money is being put out by the American consumer into the insurance business for healthcare, into the hospitals, how many millions of dollars are being donated to the hospitals who are tax-exempt nonprofit organizations, and, of course, how much overcharging is being done to the medical patients. Just so you can see where I can substantiate the argument that the medical industry and the health insurance businesses across the country could afford to pay for this without the American people having to substantially continue the premiums that they are paying now, without the American people not being afforded the competitive insurance market that they deserve, because the competition would be opened up. The insurance industry would be deregulated. The same level of service would have to be provided in any hospital in the United States, whether you are in Guam, Puerto Rico, or New York City. So we'll take a look at that, and thank you. If you have any comments for me, email me at voicethepeopleradio@hotmail.com. That's hotmail.com. That's pretty easy. voicethepeopleradio@hotmail.com. You can put attention Medicare, Medicaid,